If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to gather around the virtual water cooler and talk about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, before we go any further, I want to thank the multitude of listeners who wrote in with reactions to the discussion that we had on the podcast about the best way to find things to watch. Ryan and I were talking about that earlier, and we got a ton of emails about this, and I don't have time to read all of them. But suffice it to say, the two services that were mentioned more than any others were Just Watch and Letterboxd. And apparently you can create personalized watch lists on both of those apps and mark down what streaming services you subscribe to and filter by genre and things like that. And then you can also try to like narrow down what you're going to watch based on the subscription services that you have and all that. Anyway, it sounds very nice and easy and like exactly kind of what we were asking for. Andrew from Austin also wrote in recommending an app called Q-U-E-U-E, which I've never heard of before, but he says it has a best-in-class user interface. So maybe people might be interested in checking that out too. I personally have been using Letterboxd a lot this year to log every movie that I've seen in 2024, but I've not taken advantage of any of the watch list or other functionality that's there. So I need to look into doing that. But thank you all for writing in. Jacob, I know we're probably going to be running pretty long on today's episode, but real quick, do you have a method for like, it's Friday night, you sit down on the couch and you're going to watch something. What do you do to like figure out a way to figure out what you're going to watch?
I'm a simple man, Ben. I have a, on my notes app on my phone, I have a list called To Watch, and I'll open it and go, there's a thing. And I'll go and I'll compare it with my wife and we'll pick one from that list. And the list has things on there that have been on there for 2 or 3 years and things that were added last week. It just depends on which one we decide to watch.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same boat. Okay, well, thank you all for writing in. Those emails were super helpful. Okay, speaking of emails, Jake from Ontario wrote in to us on June 30th and had a question for you specifically, Jacob. So he says his question concerns the growing disparity between the TV critic and audience tomato meter scores on Rotten Tomatoes. He says, The Boys, The Acolyte, and The Bear all received glowing critic scores and negative audience scores. In a recent episode, Jacob mentioned that although he loved the first three seasons of The Boys, he didn't enjoy season four and passed the review to a colleague who liked it more. This practice caught my attention. Could you discuss the prevalence and ethics of this practice? Wouldn't it be good business to publish a negative review when 9 out of 10 sites are praising a show? In my opinion, Jacob would have been the perfect person to review the season and represent a large contingent of the audience who is not just reacting to the anti-MAGA politics, as some suggest is the reason for the lower audience score. I'm sorry if this sounds prickly. I'm legitimately curious to hear your thoughts. P.S. Please focus on this specific practice and avoid discussing review bombing or the binary nature of the tomato meter, as those topics have been covered well by the podcast in the past. First of all, thank you, Jake, for this email. And also thank you for that P.S., like narrowing the subject matter. I really appreciate like, all right, zero in on the thing that I really want to hear about. So, Jacob, what is your answer to this?
It's actually much simpler than I think what Jake is hoping for, which is that when I'm watching, for the case of The Boys, I'm watching this season because I'm going to interview Eric Kripke. I volunteered to do the review as well. And frankly, I have very limited writing time. As my current duties at Slash Film, I spend 7.5 on my 8-hour workday managing a team and approving pitches and working with data folks to figure out, you know, what's going to be successful on the site. I have to be very, very picky about what I choose to write. And if you see my byline on Slash Film these days, it's because something either caught on fire and we needed help, or because it's something that I felt extremely passionate about. And frankly, I did not feel extremely passionate about The Boys season four. And whereas members of my team generally were, they were excited by it. They enjoyed it. They non-cynically were like, I'm excited about this season and liked what I saw. And frankly, I said, do I want to devote a few hours of my time to working on this review when I'm going to just be circling around in something that I didn't even hate. I just kind of didn't like.
Yeah.
Or do I want to give it to somebody who wants to champion it and celebrate it? And for years, I mean, this is a conversation that Peter Sreda and I would have back in the day when Peter was still, you know, at Slash Film, is does Slash Film want to be a place where we drag things down or a place where we uplift things we enjoy? And that's why at a film festival, if two people see the same screening, like if Chris and I are both at the same screening at Subway Southwest, we'll both turn to each other and say, okay, who liked that more? Or like I'll say, I thought that was only okay, but Chris said, oh, I really liked it. I'll say, okay, Chris, you take the review. And it's because for me, I would much rather Slash Film be a place where we recommend things that we think you would like, as opposed to drag down things that we don't like. And in the case of The Boys, it was purely me going, God, I'm already busy. I'm already swamped. I already have the interviews to work on. And meanwhile, the other people in our boys chat are like, man, this season was awesome. I really enjoyed it. And I can't speak to, you know, disparity between audience and, you know, critic score here. And I don't want to dwell on it because Jake asked us not to. But yeah, this is also a similar case where I didn't like The Bear season 3. I wasn't assigned to review it. I know Chris liked it more than I did. He gave it a positive review. But yeah, I just think that there's a bigger conversation to be had here, and one where I wish I can give a full-fledged answer. But in terms of the actual practice, it's just a matter of the Slash Film voice always having been, I would rather recommend something enthusiastically. If the enthusiasm comes from an honest, pure place, then drag something down. And that's always been how I've chosen to approach it. So the ethics really come down to Jacob was tired. Jacob likes to spend his time on things he likes these days.
Yeah, well, it's funny because we've never really had a conversation about this even internally. It's just kind of been like an understood thing. And so I'm very much on the same page with you. It comes down to two things for me, like time and then the passion that people have for whatever the thing is that they're writing about comes through in the writing and makes for better writing, that like writing that I would much rather read. I would much rather read somebody who's passionate about a thing in one direction or another than somebody who's just like, I don't know, this thing was okay, which we all have to write stuff like that about, you know, sometimes anyway. But when there's the opportunity, I feel like we always take the opportunity to just like pass the assignment to whoever feels the most passionate about it. It just makes sense that way, I think. So,
Yeah, so I'm glad Jake asked this question because this is something that I would love to be open about. And, you know, sometimes a review lands on somebody's desk and they hate the thing and they say, I hate this enough that I want to write about it. Or, you know, they're the only possible option. Like, they're the only person who can do a screening, the only person who saw it. But generally, I just want Slash Film to be a place where people celebrate things they love and uplift what they enjoy first and foremost. And it's not always possible. But that's always been my editorial directive. And, you know, I people are encouraged to be honest in the other articles. Like, I'll read articles on slashfilm.com from writers where I go, man, I like this writer. I like work with this person every day. But here they're crazy. They're absolutely crazy here. I got to think people who like The Bear season 3 are crazy. Sorry, Ben.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Yeah. Well, I'm curious to hear more about your Bear season 3 thoughts coming up in just a minute. Before we get into what we've been watching, though, let's touch on what we've been reading. I mentioned on a previous episode of the show that I'm still reading this big book called Hollywood, The Oral History. So I'll talk about that when I'm done. I'm like, I don't know, probably three quarters of the way through right now. So I've still got a little ways to go. But what have you been reading recently, Jacob?
I have a trio of books. I can recommend them all to various degrees. I'll start with Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. This is the guy who wrote The Martian. And I skipped his second book, Artemis, because the response to it wasn't great. But Project Hail Mary got much better reviews. And I've been hearing about it since it came out in 2021, that it's a hell of a read. And it's currently being filmed as a movie from Lord Miller, you know, the guys who adapt Impossible Things. This is a very tough adaptation, written by Drew Goddard, who wrote the Martian film, which I love, starring Ryan Gosling, who's kind of perfect for the leading role here. And I will say I listened to the audiobook for Project Hail Mary, and it has the single best audiobook performance I've ever heard and some of the best production values I've ever heard in an audiobook. So if you are an audiobook person at all, Project Hail Mary, you should listen to it. Because I thought the performance is so funny and moving. I was crying at the end, and the book may have a similar experience if you read it, but I found the audiobook to be just top tier, incredible work. And I'm hesitant to talk too much about this because the trailers for Project Hail Mary are going to give away why this thing is special. Mm. The flap description on the book does not give it away. And all I'll say is that it starts off feeling like The Martian at a bigger scale. A character has to solve a space problem using limited resources. And but instead of being, you know, one person's life at stake, it's a much, much bigger thing. And then it changes. It changes in a way that I found really exciting. And it's a huge swing and one that I thought was genuinely amazing. This is one of the most entertaining books I've listened to / read in a long time. I had a blast with Project Hail Mary. And the fact that it does not feel like it's adaptable makes me more excited to see what Lord Miller do with it, because if anybody I can trust to take something that feels this impossible and to bring it to the big screen, it's those guys.
Let me ask you a stupid question. I have never listened to an audiobook before. Is there only one audiobook that's like widely accessible everywhere? Like if I go to my library and try to rent the audiobook for Project Hail Mary, is that going to be the same one that I have access to if I got it through Audible or, you know, whatever other service that is out there?
9 times out of 10, yes. Occasionally they will re-record audiobooks. I know that when The Martian took off, like when it became a much bigger deal, they brought in Will Wheaton to record a new version that kind of replaced the older audiobook, which I know like annoyed some people because there's nothing wrong with the old audiobook. It just wasn't a famous name. Mm-hmm. Similarly, when Three Body Problem hit Netflix, they released a new audiobook with Rosalind Chao reading it instead of the original narrator. And I believe in that case, you can still find both. But in the case of The Martian, the original one's kind of been scrubbed away. But that's very uncommon. It's usually only for like huge blockbuster type events, like adaptations like that. In the case of Project Hail Mary, there only is one audiobook. And from what I gathered, it actually won all the audiobook awards the year came out. Like the audiobook, it won the audiobook Oscar, so to speak.
Oh, cool.
So it should be the only one out there. And yeah, I know some people are, you know, prefer always reading, you know, books regularly. And I totally understand. Like I try to read, I try to split 50-50 between audiobooks and physical books these days. Project Hail Mary is one of the ones where I genuinely feel the audiobook enhanced my experience of enjoying it.
Excellent. Okay. So that's Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. And then the next book you're going to talk about, weirdly enough, Jacob, is sitting on my like desk right now. I'm looking at it. It's practically in my hands because my wife just finished reading it and she was like, you have to read this. So I'm planning on reading it right after I finish my current book. So this book is called Dark Matter by Blake Crouch. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I picked it up because it's was adapted into a Apple TV Plus miniseries recently. And I wanted to watch it, I've actually owned a physical book since it first came out, like in 2016. I've never read it, which is a huge problem of mine, buying books that just sit around. So I made it my next audiobook. The audiobook actually it's fine. It's not an essential audiobook like Project Hail Mary is. So you can definitely enjoy reading this one straightforward. But Blake Crouch is probably best known for the Wayward Pines books, which were made into a TV series before this. And yeah, this is, without spoiling too much, it's about a ordinary family man, a college professor, who finds himself the subject of a multiverse adventure. And by adventure, I mean a nightmare. It's very horror-tinged sci-fi, sort of what if Everything Everywhere All at Once was an A24 horror movie instead of an A24 comedy.
Hmm.
I found it to be really exciting and really creepy and really enjoyable. So it's a fast read. Like even the audiobook, you know, is brisk. I mean, it's like 300 something pages. It really reads like a movie, which is why I was kind of surprised it became a show. I think the show actually will probably need to expand the book in order to make it fit a whole season of TV, because it's a lean, mean little thing. But yeah, it's very good. And if you like, you know, if you like multiverse stories, if you like science fiction, if you like feel bad science fiction, this is going to be something you'll enjoy a lot.
I have to issue a correction. The book that she just read was called Recursion, and that was by Blake Crouch. But she read that and then immediately ordered Dark Matter. So I have to add this book to our like sort of digital library, Dewey Decimal System type of thing that we've got going on for our library at home. So she has not read Dark Matter yet, but I think she liked Recursion so much that she was like, I have to read this pretty
soon.
Recursion
is also sitting on my bookshelf unread when I first
read. Okay. Excellent. All right. Well, crisscrossing back and forth here.
Maybe I'll read that one next.
Excellent. Okay. What else have you been up to?
I would recommend some nonfiction. Challenger by Adam Higginbottom. Adam Higginbottom wrote Midnight in Chernobyl, a book that I read a few years ago when the HBO series Chernobyl hit. And I think I talked about the book on the podcast then, and I was obsessed with it. This is one of the best nonfiction books I'd ever read. It really painted a deeply complex and terrifying situation, the Chernobyl disaster in the Soviet Union, like with a really clear-eyed brush. And I really understood everything that had happened, why it was important, and it was written... So many great nonfiction writers are, you know, they're historians. They're there to, you know, inform you. Not all of them have, you know, the novelist panache of Adam Higginbottom, whose work just really has this propulsive narrative to it. Like you can't put it down. It has the pacing and structure and flow of great fiction, even though it's, you know, actually great journalism. And Challenger is his look at the 1986 Challenger disaster, where the space shuttle exploded, killing all the astronauts on board. And in order to explain how this happened and why it happened, he literally has to go back to the 60s and sort of explain the entire history of NASA and every single step leading up to the shuttle program and what went wrong during that process. And as somebody who's always, you know, had a very distant view of the Challenger, you know, this book's been very illuminating and it's definitely added a new note of cynicism into how I see the world, because it's very clear that Higginbottom's point here is that men and women, as brave, intelligent, and like almost supernaturally good at their jobs as astronauts, should have all of the backing and trust and like resources available to them at all. But the number of corners cut by everybody to have allowed this to happen is staggering. So the book has left me really fascinated, but also really angry, but also like just so impressed by astronauts and so deeply unimpressed by the foundation that serves them and how half-assed the entire space program has always been since the 60s. So I found this to be pretty vital reading, and I hope other people do too.
Okay, well, that's a great recommendation as well. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and get into what we've been watching. All right, Jacob, I watched a movie called The Last Stop in Yuma County. Have you seen this yet?
No, but you talked about it with me briefly in our work Slack about how much you liked it.
Yeah, so this is Francis Galluppi, I think is how you pronounce his name. I'm butchering that. I apologize to the director. It's his feature directorial debut. I went into this movie really knowing almost nothing about it, except from hearing several people that I trust say that it was worthwhile. So I really don't want to get too much into what the movie is, because that's kind of part of the fun of watching it. I will just say that it is a small-scale crime thriller starring an actor named Jim Cummings, who has been in a lot of like small stuff that I enjoy. And the story takes place at a diner on the side of a desolate highway. And I'll just kind of leave it at that. Like, things go wrong. But I thought the performances were really fun here. The script is pretty tight. I mean, it's not exactly a movie that has like a ton on its mind. But for what it is, which is this, yeah, like I said, just a really entertaining crime thriller, I thought it was really enjoyable. And it goes to some very unexpected places. So I would recommend seeking this out. It's available to rent on digital right now. And it's coming to Blu-ray on July 16th, if you're a fan of physical media. So the movie is called The Last Stop in Yuma County. And I would recommend checking it out. I'd really be curious to know what you think about it, Jacob, because it's not going to like, I don't know. It's one of those movies that I think is just going to be like a quiet release, you know. Like, I think it got a small theatrical release earlier this year. It's definitely a like fall through the crack type of movie, you know, where it's not going to be on a ton of people's best of the year list, just because it's probably not going to be super widely seen. But I think the people who do see it are going to come away really enjoying it. So yeah, Last Stop in Yuma County is the name of that book, or the movie rather. I also caught up with Luca Guadagnino's 2015 movie, A Bigger Splash. Have you ever seen this?
No, this is actually the one Luca film I don't think I've seen. And I remember, I so vividly remember when this came out being like, man, this sounds like art house nonsense. It sounds like it would be unbearable. And since then, I've seen and loved every other movie he's made. And now I realize that I really should not have judged this book by its cover. I probably should go back and watch it.
Yeah, I have not seen all of his stuff. I've only seen a handful of his movies. I saw Call Me By Your Name. I saw Challengers, obviously, very recently. And I'm trying to go back and sort of fill in my blind spots with him. And this movie I thought was going to be like absolutely my shit. Like, it is set in this lush Italian countryside, and it has one of the most gorgeous locations that I've ever seen in a movie. It is just this beautiful house out there, like isolated, where you could rent this, you know, you can imagine yourself paying thousands and thousands of dollars to rent this gorgeous villa and just like spend all of your time drinking and swimming in this pool up here and having like the greatest vacation of your life. But ultimately, I really did not get what this movie was going for. I have to say, I did not care for it too much, which is really unfortunate, because I was really going into this expecting it to be like a huge hit with me personally, and it just ended up not being that. But
maybe my first impression was correct.
I think it is in this case, yeah. Because I honestly came away feeling like, I don't even know what you're trying to do here, you know, and it really did feel kind of like art house nonsense to me, which is probably blasphemy to a lot of people who love Luca. And I know there's a lot of love out there for this movie specifically, but man, I was not on its wavelength at all. Tilda Swinton plays a rock star who has just finished a tour and is trying to save her voice. So she doesn't really speak throughout this movie. She occasionally whispers, but it's largely gestural performance from her, which was pretty interesting and kind of unusual. So the premise is that she and her documentarian boyfriend rent this gorgeous villa where they plan to relax and spend all this time together. But suddenly her ex, played by Ralph Fiennes, shows up with a daughter that he never knew that he had. It's played by Dakota Johnson, and basically like forces his way into staying with them at this villa. And the movie is supposed to be the story about jealousy and kind of testing the central romance between the main characters, but Ralph Fiennes' character is such a whirlwind, and not in a good way, that I just really did not enjoy spending time in this world and with these characters. Like, he is such a nightmare personality that it managed to even like taint the gorgeous location and like that like summery sun dappled vibe that you get with a little bit of like Call Me By Your Name. Aesthetically, that's going on in this movie too, but the story is just like so unhinged in a way, because this Ralph Fiennes character is just like so wild and such a like a Tasmanian devil of a character that it just kind of like ruined the whole experience for me. So anyway, the movie's called A Bigger Splash. I'm like very much aware that I'm in the minority and not liking this movie, but I just wanted to share my response anyway. So if anybody has any defenses of the film or anything, or you want to write in to tell me I'm an idiot, feel free to do that. I'll give you the email address at the very end of the show. A couple more things I've been checking out, Jacob. I watched a movie called The Paper. Have you ever seen this from 1994? The Ron Howard movie, The Paper?
No, but this feels like a You movie.
It was a me movie for, I don't know, 80% of the movie, maybe 90% even. It's a journalism movie, which I love journalism movies, and it is set at a newspaper in New York City, and Michael Keaton is in this, Glenn Close, Marissa Tomei, Robert Duvall, Randy Quaid. It's got a really great cast, and it's basically about 24 hours in the lives of these newspaper people who are trying to crack this story about two white businessmen who have been murdered in a part of the city, and these two black teenagers who have been arrested for the crime. And the journalists are convinced that these kids are innocent of this crime, but the whole media ecosystem is like out to just fall into the typical patterns, the typical narratives that you would expect. So it's about Michael Keaton's character, who's the editor of this paper, trying to, or one of the editors anyway, trying to sort of push back and like take a stand for what's right in this world of journalism. So I really, really liked almost all of this movie until maybe the last, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes or something, where it just like completely goes off the rails and like becomes a totally different thing and becomes so over the top and like tonally different than what everything that came before, that I was kind of like left with a pretty weird taste in my mouth after the movie. But I don't know, I would still recommend it, especially if you love journalism movies like I do, because so much of the movie is so good, and it's very like shoe leathery and like boots on the ground and people actually like doing stuff, and You know, there's just like a an inherent nostalgia to seeing a way that a newsroom used to operate in the mid 90s that obviously like the funding for the entire news industry and newspapers as a whole and all of that have completely lost the supremacy that they have in our cultural society and all that now. But it's just interesting as a time capsule piece to go back. And it's also, I guess, interesting when you look at it as like a Ron Howard movie. So that adds a whole other element as well. But like Jason Alexander has a small role in this movie. It's just wild. Like Catherine O'Hara shows up for one scene. So it's just got a really terrific stacked cast. So this movie is on Netflix right now, I think, or it was when I watched it. It may have vanished off of there, but it's called The Paper. And I would recommend checking out, even if it kind of loses its way at the very end there for a second. And then lastly, I'll just really quickly mention this movie that I watched mostly as a joke called Calloway Went That-Away. This is one of those instances where I was just flipping through Turner Classic Movies and just seeing what was coming up on the schedule. And I saw this movie and I was like, well, that title is ridiculous. I have to record this and watch this. And I sort of like jokingly suggested it to my wife one night. And because it was 82 minutes long, she's like, yeah, sure. Why not? Let's give this a go. And it's basically about... It sounds very familiar. Like this premise has kind of been used in other movies and things like that in subsequent years. This movie came out in 1951, and it's this comedy quasi-Western about basically the co-owners of an advertising firm managed to find a bunch of old Western movies and turn them into successful serials on television. And it's become like the biggest thing in the country. And like kids that across the nation are like freaking out about this Western series that these advertising people have created. And they have idolized the star of this, what is now a TV show. And so these advertising executives are basically like, all right, well, we have to find the guy who starred in this stuff because all of the, you know, all these different companies want to come out and make cereals and hats and toys and put, you know, plaster this guy's face and likeness all over these different products because this show is so popular. So we have to find this guy so we can get him to sign away the rights and so he can get paid and all this stuff. And they can't find the guy. So they end up finding a person who looks exactly like him. And they basically hire him to step in and like become this figure. And then, of course, the real guy shows up. And then there's just a lot of like wacky hijinks that ensue after that. So, you know, the movie's like pretty entertaining for what it is. It's not like one of the greatest things I've ever seen. It's very, very goofy. But Fred McMurray is in it. I know him from Double Indemnity and a bunch of other movies. But yeah, I don't know. It was a pleasant experience. And yeah, it's kind of fun to watch. It reminded me a little bit of like the Would That It Were So Simple sort of subplot of, what was that? Hail Caesar, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, Calloway Went That Away. I would say it was worth 82 minutes of my time. So, okay, what have you been watching, Jacob?
I'm assuming you guys have discussed The Bear Season 3 at length on the show, right?
We did, yes.
Okay, I'll be very brief. I'm struggling. I haven't finished it yet. I'm more than halfway through. But I find every episode of this season, with a handful of exceptions, to be just a slog. Like, I really like episode 6, and I enjoyed episode 2. But the rest of it just feels like it's vanished up its own butt in a way that I find really upsetting. It stopped being funny. It stopped being stressful. It just started being lots of shots of people looking at each other and asking us to add our own depth to what I think has become a very shallow show. I feel really bad for saying, because I think seasons 1 and 2 are some of the best TV ever made. But The Bear Season 3 feels like a show that bought into its own hype and thought I can get away with anything and took some big swings that I don't think connect at all. And I feel awful because I think that everybody involved in the show is really talented. And justice for Richie. But man, this is not The Bear I fell in love with.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly not the first person to say that. I think we are actually kind of in the outlier section of the critical community when Brad and Chris and I both, or all three of us, really liked the show, and we were talking about it in our big spoiler episode. So I'm glad to have you on here and represent what I think is a widely held opinion about the drop in quality in the season. And I think a lot of people have felt like the show is very much spinning its wheels in season 3. And I think even, you know, those of us who liked it kind of recognized that too. But I think, I think we're maybe a little bit more lenient on it because of hopefully because of what is to come. And I'm not going to say anything about how the season ends since you haven't gotten there yet, Jacob, but I think a lot of our praise for the show is giving it leeway for what could happen in season four. And if season four shits the bed or something like that, then I think we'll look back on the third season and the comments that we made about it and in a much different light. So I hope that the show is able to sort of pull up out of this or maybe a better way is not to indicate that it's in a nosedive, but to maybe just like push the gas pedal down again. Whereas this season, it kind of like let its foot off the gas and seemed to be coasting a little bit. And as these characters find themselves in various degrees of being stuck or indecisive. So I totally understand why people have major issues with the show, but I'm hoping that you'll at least like how it ends, Jacob, but we'll see, I guess.
Yeah. I would love to love the bear again. I still think those first two seasons are literally some of the best TV ever made. So fingers crossed that, you know, this is just the weak season and it come back and surprise me again.
Yeah. What else have you been watching?
I started watching Ghosts. This is a CBS comedy based on the BBC comedy of the same name. My wife loves it and it's really encouraging me to watch, like, check it out. And I'll be honest, at first I wasn't sure. I think the pilot is actually kind of actively not good. I was like, oh man. And some of the performances in the pilot just weren't working for me. And it kind of, I found it really cheesy and just oof. But I stuck with it and, you know, about halfway through season one right now, and I'm actually really, really enjoying it now. This turned into a show that I find very pleasant, very easy to watch. Sometimes it takes the easy route out because it still is a CBS sitcom. But I can now hardly recommend it, but also say that, yes, I don't think it has a strong start, but I think it finds its groove. The premise of the show is this couple, this city couple, inherit a crumbling mansion out in the countryside. And what they don't know is that it's haunted by, I think it's 9 different ghosts who've all died there over the centuries. The oldest one is a Viking warrior who died 5,000 years ago. The most recent ghost, you know, is like a Wall Street douchebag who died in the 90s. And the woman who inherited the house suffers a head injury, goes into a coma, wakes up and can see ghosts. And it's about her trying to renovate this old mansion and balance her new life, where she essentially has 9 undead roommates, all who have their own issues and foibles. And it's very, very pleasant. It had, you know, if you're looking for like a Brooklyn Nine-Nine or, you know, Parks and Rec style, everybody hangs out and has a good time and loves each other in the end style comedy, this is probably going to scratch an itch. Probably not as hard as those shows did. I don't think it's as funny as those shows, but I really like its vibes. I've reached a point where I just kind of find myself vibing with the characters and enjoy my time with them. Even when it is, you know, following some very traditional sitcom tropes, even when it is, you know, reminding you, oh yes, this is still a CBS show made for, you know, the widest audience possible, I think it's just clever enough and just funny enough and just sweet enough and just charming enough. Also just visually interesting enough. They do some really cool stuff with the ghosts and with the set. And I find myself increasingly interested in the, you know, Beetlejuice-esque rules of what it means to be a ghost and how the afterlife works in this fictional world. So yeah, Ghosts. If you just need something that's really nice and it's not going to challenge you, but it's also not, you know, low quality junk. It's, you know, I guess, you know, high quality, accessible entertainment. And Ghost is scratching that itch for me. And I sometimes I just need a show that's the opposite of challenge. I need the opposite of the bear sometimes. I just need something that's going to go down as easily as possible. So that's, if that's something you need in your life right now, and I think we all need that right now, then Ghost is a good choice.
Okay, so Ghosts, I think, is on CBS, and then I want to say it's, you can stream it on Paramount Plus. Is that right? Is that how you've been catching up on
Paramount Plus right now? Right now, my Paramount Plus homepage is all Star Trek and Ghosts.
What you need is Ghosts in Star Trek. Is that a thing that happens?
Ooh, the infamous season 7 episode of Star Trek Next Generation, where Dr. Beverly Crusher meets the family ghost, is one of the worst episodes of Star Trek ever made. So, yeah.
I knew I was coming to the right person for that. Okay, what else have you been watching, Jacob?
Another movie that's been discussed in the show already, so I'll be brief. Quiet Place Day One. I really like Quiet Place 1 and 2. Like, so this is not me putting them down when I say this, but this is my favorite Quiet Place movie by a pretty fair margin. I think that Michael Tarnowski is a really gifted filmmaker, and that he made a movie about choosing to be kind when you have no time left, but package it into a giant, you know, horror blockbuster is really impressive. I'm shocked Paramount let him get away with it. I don't know how he got away with it. But movies that are this, you know, character driven and subtle and really moving, but are also giant monster movies, just excellent stuff. Love this one. Just couldn't get enough of it. Kind of obsessed with it. And yeah, I really hope that the Quiet Place movies continue to be a platform on which really interesting filmmakers can tell their stories, because John Krasinski clearly, you know, used his movies to explore themes of family and what you would do to sacrifice for those you love. Michael Tarnowski clearly wants to deal with loss and, you know, accepting loss. And man, I don't know what Quiet Place 4 looks like, but I really hope it's more of this, please. More of this character-driven, idea-driven, theme-driven blockbuster filmmaking. This is the kind of thing where if we are going to have franchise tent poles, they should all be this thoughtful and well-made.
Yeah, very well said. Very well said. I loved BJ's interview with Michael Tarnowski. So if people are just listening to this episode for the first time or something and haven't listened to that, I would really, really recommend going back and scrolling back on your podcast app and listening to that episode, because I thought they had a really great conversation. So check that out.
One quick thing.
Yes, yes.
I realized that I meant to bring this up. I mentioned Challenger, the book by Adam Higginbottom earlier. And I just want to say that Challenger makes you want to apologize to Jurassic World.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I got to wrap my head around that one. What do you mean by that?
Wait, I don't like Jurassic World. I don't think it's a good movie. It maybe has some good moments, but there is one element of it that has been derided and mocked and described as unrealistic since the movie came out, and that is that the idea that there are dinosaurs cloned living in a theme park, that people are bored by them, like kids texting through the T-Rex display. I remember filmmakers and critics alike being furious at this concept, being like, man, if there were actual dinosaurs, we would never get over it. How dare this movie suggest that this is something that is like that people would like get bored by. And I was among them. I was like, man, if there were a dinosaur theme park, I would never stop talking about it. And I thought that this was so unrealistic and so stupid, and it was such a cynical read on the idea of what Jurassic Park's built upon. But reading Challenger and learning that 2 years after the first moon landing, that people were actively complaining to networks about like their medical dramas being delayed because of moon footage. And people were writing in droves and calling in droves saying, we don't care about the moon anymore. Bring back this medical drama. Or why is our soap opera not playing? And I realized, oh no, Jurassic World was right. Our capacity for wonder does die quickly and does have a shelf life far more limited than we could have thought possible. If people are bored by the moon 2 years after the first moon landing, then yes, people will be bored by cloned dinosaurs 10 years after cloned dinosaurs hit the theme park. I'm convinced of it. I'm sorry, Colin Trevorrow. I don't like your movie, but you were right about this. I'm sorry.
What a way to go out, man. Oh, what a great ending for this podcast episode. And again, that makes me just really want to read that book. So well done, Jacob. The book is called Challenger by Adam Higginbotham. All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find a lot more about the stories that were mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really, really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.